Yes, hello, folks. Welcome to the second in the series of podcasts. We are United Podcast. I am delighted to be joined with the excellent Andy Mitten, following on the heels of Pete Boyle. He said it's all downhill from here. So, Andy, how you doing, mate?
Fine, Phil. Cheers. Looking forward to it.
Yes, my pleasure. For those of you, if there's someone out there that there is that doesn't know who Andy is, of course, a prolific United journalist, hosts the excellent United We Stand podcast, and of course, the excellent Talk of the Devils podcast. I listen to a few different United podcasts. It's all I have time for in the week, and these are ones I never miss. So, extremely informative, funny, well done, well hosted, good chemistry, and the United We Stand one's very different, which I love. And actually, I've said this before to Andy, the reason, the brainchild behind this whole podcast was the United We Stand podcast. I'm going to get you to talk a little bit about that. But Andy, you're also, of course, a fanzine editor. I don't know how you manage all these things. Something that I've been integrating into this podcast recently is making sure we share a message of support in our fanzines, which are very, very important. Tell me about United We Stand and why it's so important.
Well, it's been going for nearly 35 years now. It's actually going all right, Phil. We hit the record number of subscriptions last month. So people are supporting it. Our readers are very loyal, whether they buy it at the ground, whether they subscribe. Really nice to have face-to-face interaction. And they get it that it's not free. You have to buy it. And we use that money to produce a mag that you buy in print. It's really difficult for a lot of print titles, newspapers, magazines. So I don't know why it's going fine, maybe because I've not put the price up for a long time, but there's very good writing in there. We don't do clickbait. We don't need to do clickbait. We reflect the cultures. Everything we do is well-sourced, and a lot of time and energy goes into that. And without that, probably 40 people contributing to United We Stand, be it that sellers outside the stadium, people on the podcast, writers, drawn from a big spectrum, you know. The media is, in the UK, it's still very class-driven. If you look at where the backgrounds of a lot of people in journalism in the UK, they're really posh. They went to private schools, and there's nothing wrong with that, but that's not reflective of society as a whole. And I'd like to think we give a chance to talent. And so many people have started writing for United We Stand and gone on to become professional writers. And some people have got no interest whatsoever in becoming professional writers. They're good fanzine writers. They're humorous. We've got people who are good at doing interviews. And
yeah,
I take a great pride in it. I write for all these different people and do me fancy stuff for me work, but love standing outside Old Trafford or an away ground with copies of United We Stand. It's not just the writers, we've got artists who contribute to it, and it's going well. I'm pleased it's going well. It's irreverent, it's esoteric. I always say to people, give me something you're not going to find online. Tell me something new. Yes. And because if people are paying with their hard-earned money, it's got to be worth buying. You can't serve shit up. It's got to be good. So I'd like to think that, you know, while I am biased, I'd like to think it is good.
Well, I think obviously yourself, Red News, I was a long-time subscriber to Red Issue. And I think some of the things that I loved about it, Andy, is that it done two things. It informed and it entertained. That is really hard to do. If something's going to captivate me, I want to learn something that I didn't know before I opened it or before I listened to anything that you have to say. And there's the analysis side of football and all, which is great. You know, should have played 4-4-2. Should, you know, this guy played well, that guy played well. But then there's the other side of this. I mean, some of the content in United We Stand is extremely well informed about gossip that goes on inside the football club. It's exceptionally well sourced. And it also gives a very, very important voice to fans that don't always have an outlet anymore. And so, you know, you're quite right in that the Sky Sports and all the major outlets are really only going to one or two people. And one of the things that I've learned over the years, and I if anyone else is listening to this, do media bits, I'm sure you support this message, is do not claim you speak for Manchester United fans. You know, make sure you understand that you speak for yourself. And I think United fans get angry when someone goes on TV or goes on different platforms and claims they speak for United fans when they clearly don't. But this is an exceptional way to get that diversity viewpoint of different United fans through a fanzine and something that's really on the ground. The other part about it is, Andy, when I was learning about fan culture, United fan culture, a lot of this was shaped. I grew up in Belfast, so I wasn't on the ground in Manchester, but my understanding of the things that were really important to Manchester United and Manchester United fans, I found out from fanzines.
Fan culture is important, and that comes on the ground, and there are issues which affect fans, stuff like ticket prices, the atmosphere, and a lot can spread out from that. And you're quite right saying no one can speak for United fans. And sometimes the media get that wrong. You'll see people quoted as like a fans leader. A what? A fans leader? You can't speak for millions of people. It's absolutely impossible. But if you're informed and you know your stuff, and you know, we've done it for a long time. I listen to lots of different fans. I stand there. I speak to people. I hear what people say. You get a really good inkling for what the mood is. Mm-hmm. And if you can reflect that, and there are issues like atmosphere, the songs in the ground, the price of things, the travel, you know, doesn't affect a lot of people who watch Manchester United games, but try and work out how to get back from an away game that's been shifted for television when the last train leaves 10 minutes before the end of the match. And a lot of people don't care about stuff like that. Stuff like that doesn't really go viral because there's not actually that many people at the matches as a percentage of Manchester United's overall support. But for us, it's really important. But also, reflecting that wider support, in the last year, I went to Islamabad to meet the Pakistani Reds. Brilliant. Mm-hmm. And they were telling me stories about how difficult it is for them to get a visa to go to a game in the UK. Not about getting a ticket. They could get the tickets. They couldn't get a visa. Yes. And they booked trips. And I love this huge diaspora of Manchester United fans. And I've been lucky to travel around the world and meet Reds everywhere. And it's really humbling because I was fortunate to grow up 2 miles from Old Trafford. And you could go anywhere. Honestly, if I put a tweet out now saying, well, I've done this, I'm going to Tehran.
Yeah.
I had 8 different people going, are you really coming to Tehran? We'll meet you. I'm like, how on earth are you getting Twitter in Iran? Aha. Well, my uncle lives in Canada and we use a VPN. And yeah, we get your articles this way. And it's wonderful. So much good can come from Manchester United's vast fan base, and I'm really proud of that. And we try and reflect all of that, not in a way that's going to appeal to transfer junkies. Because some people want shite.
I know.
They just want clickbait. Mm-hmm. And they click on it because that's what humans do.
Mm-hmm.
We're a slower read. We can do it in a slightly different way. And I'm just buzzing that people still buy it and support it so long after we started it.
Mate, I think, you know, one of the things that you did this over the summer at the tour that I really, really loved was the individual stories of United fans. One of the things that's special about football clubs, I'm sure all the football clubs would say the same, but United have this unifying identity that transcends cultural divides, religious divides, conflicts. I mean, I said this to people, and when I was, first time I went to Old Trafford was 91, and the troubles were raging at the time. And when we get on the bus, there was no Protestant, Catholic, there was no nationalist. We're just all United fans. We just had this commonality that transcended everything else that we united under. And you hear this with people that whose cultures oppose each other, their nations are at war with each other, yet somehow Manchester United are able to bridge that divide. Listen to some of the stories of regular United fans, of what they go through to watch Manchester United, but not just that. How Manchester United have been so important to them at difficult times in their life when you're struggling for hope and you realize, I mean, we even saw this during COVID, how football, Manchester United is so much more than just a game on the weekend.
Belfast is a really good example where you're from. And we did a live podcast there in October. And I've been before, I've written about football there, and it's pretty lively. And I was there in the troubles, and we spoke to 500 or 600 people. And I was well aware that people there were drawn from all sides of the community. And I was absolutely fine with that. And I went into Ardoin, where I saw the Palestine flags. Mm-hmm. And I crossed over the road into the Shankill, where I saw the Israel flags. This is very alive now.
Yeah.
And yeah. I took my wife, and she couldn't believe that these barriers are there. And yet I saw Manchester United shirts on both sides of the community. Oh, and I was saying that my great-grandmother was from Northern Ireland. Her three sons were professional footballers. And one played for Manchester United. Others played for Portadown, for Ballymena. And as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, that clearly shows that my great-grandmother was from a Protestant background. So straight away, I'm thinking, half the audience here are thinking, right, he's one of them. So I did have to clarify that I am the only person in my immediate family, which includes my wife and my children, who's not a Roman Catholic. Even my dog's Catholic, because I can tell the way she looks at me sometimes. And you see people from Northern Ireland, the north of Ireland, call it what you want, coming to Old Trafford, and it's just all forgotten about, the stuff in the background. And I love it. I love it that Manchester United and Liverpool, to be fair, transcends the various boundaries there. And football's a great social leveler as well.
Really?
When I stand outside Old Trafford, you get people coming up from everywhere, from all kinds of background, top business executives. You get people who, where are you from, mate? Well, I'm from Bangalore, but I live in San Francisco.
Yes.
What? And that's pretty normal.
Amazing.
I love it. I embrace it.
When you were doing the Galatasaray one, just listening to all the Galatasaray fans that were in London from all over the place, you know, before they went to Old Trafford, just so fascinating to me. And I think there's a big space there of stories that don't get told enough, Andy, because I think that it's easy to chase the breaking news market, but that has a lot of mouths to feed. And unless you're at the top, that's not, to me, something that you should be chasing, because what's the likelihood that someone like me is going to scoop, you know, you or David Ornstein and stuff? You're doing this every single day. And that's what you need to do, like the contacts that you need to have, the trust that you need to have. And what people don't understand is even the stuff that doesn't get printed, I mean, there's a lot that doesn't make the media that you know that, you know, it's not professional, it's not appropriate, whatever. This is a really hard job. And to do it right and to do it well and to be disciplined and measured in your message, which is something that I'm not, takes a lot of skill. It's so, you have been doing this a long time. Does the enthusiasm ever wane?
I love it. Someone said to me when I was very young, don't get too close to the sun. You know, that wasn't the newspaper. That was Manchester United. And I've been offered jobs at the club since I've been 17 years old. And I've always kept a distance, kept my independence, and value that. And geographically, I spend a lot of time away from Manchester, even though I'm from Manchester. And I think that helps keep my enthusiasm. I still really look forward to watching every single United game. I still think United are going to win every single game they start.
Same.
And I realise that is entirely irrational because, especially in more recent times, the probability of that is often very low, and you can have the illusion shattered within 5 minutes. For the journalism, it's hard work, but I like people. You know, it's one of the reasons we get these stories on the podcast. I like travel. I like people. I like going to new places, and maybe football gives me that backdrop. It's so much more than just what happens on the pitch over 90 minutes. But you're quite right about the working the contacts, building up the trust with people. I find as I get older, you learn a lot more and you write a lot less. You just hold stuff back. But that helps shape your writing because you know what not to write. And I think I'd be the world's worst tabloid journalist because I hold a lot of stuff back because I play a longer game. And maybe that's why people talk to me. That's maybe why people continue to talk to me and to trust me. And you know, Ole Gunnar gave me his first interview after leaving Manchester United. I waited 2 years for that. Yeah. And I know, and I won't name them, I could say 10, 15 former players. I'm pretty sure I'm the only journalist they speak to. Some of them don't like journalists. They don't like the media. They don't trust journalists. And when they tell me stuff, I often see like stories and think, well, I knew that a week ago.
Yeah,
I knew that. And maybe that's to my detriment that I'm not writing it, that I'm not just spilling it straight away. But then because I've got my independence, I'm not under pressure to do that. I've not got an editor breathing down my neck every single day saying what you're writing on the back page tomorrow. And that's a different art within itself. And journalism's changing a lot, Phil. It's changing.
We'll go there with you, yeah.
No, I did a journalism degree. I sat in courtrooms. I learned how to do shorthand, which you don't even need now. I got all my qualifications. I did it a slightly different way because United We Stand was already going. I didn't go to the local newspaper, but it worked for me the way that I did it. And I'm seeing really good journalists losing their jobs at the moment.
I know. It's brutal, mate.
Really good people, really good operators. This is real life, and I don't like it. And that's partly because of the obvious. People are not buying newspapers or consuming them in the way that they used to do.
On that, so how do you find cruising altitude, Andy, to where you're not doing clickbait? Because even The Athletic last year, had to lay off people. We saw with Sports Illustrated, people were laid off. And sometimes good journalism isn't sexy. Sometimes it's not going to get a million downloads because it's responsible, because it's accurate, because sometimes the truth is not sexy. Anyone can make things up. Anyone can exaggerate things. So how do you find a space where you can occupy between being accurate and informative, but also where it generates lots of downloads?
Sometimes you've got to drop a banger. It's all right saying, I'll do these lovely travel pieces or whatever. Sometimes you've got to go bang. Is Solskjaer's first exclusive interview. And even for United We Stand, we have to do that as well. Sometimes we had a big one with Ten Hag recently. But you're right. I spent 3 years doing an investigation for The Athletic about footballers who've been ripped off. And I'm speaking to lads who are suicidal, famous footballers.
I know.
Whose mental health is absolutely destroyed, who've lost hundreds of thousands, millions. And I spoke to Premier League chairman. I had to build up the trust of people who, if you mention their name, will go, wow, he was a great centre-forward, him. What they don't know is that person is broken, utterly broken. And I started that piece in July 2020 after I sat in the front room of Andy Cole's flat and he started telling me about how he'd been ripped off financially and how X had and Y had and A had and B had and C has. And I pulled in this massive web and then I'm speaking to lawyers. It took me 3 years. And we published it in 2023. It did all right. A few specialists and people like Kieran Maguire and respected people within the field were like, this is really good. I could have done a trivial Manchester United transfer piece, which would have been read X more number of times. And part of that is frustrating. And you do stuff and you put so much time into it. And We got that case of those players. We actually got it through to Parliament by working with people who've been victims of fraud. How sexy is famous footballers getting ripped off? There's not that much sympathy for them. Don't really realise it. How sexy was the post office scandal before ITV did a dramatisation of it? So it can work in different ways, but I'm getting paid to write about football, Phil. I'm traveling the world. There's so many, even though it's changing all the time, some of the wind is in our sails. The podcast, the Talk of the Devils one we've done, it's gone massive. And that didn't even exist 4 years ago. Books are changing. There's still a massive demand to consume football and Manchester United. Used to do more Barcelona. That's becoming more peripheral now. It's not the story it was when Messi was there. It just isn't.
And but you still love football, Andy, because I remember I was up at Big Bird last year, I was listening to one of your podcasts, and you were talking about, I'm off on Sunday, and then you're off to some obscure ground somewhere, and my wife's in the car, and she's like, how does he handle that? Like, that must be really difficult, because this guy works non-stop, he's got young kids. I mean, how difficult is that for your family to deal with the fact that you on my day off, I'm off at, Stockport's ground, or I'm off at, it's absolutely hilarious listening to you being able to rhyme off capacities, your ground names of.
I can do all of them, mate. I've been able to do them since I've been a kid. You'd name any of the 92 league grounds, I could describe them to you. I could even go deep into Northern Ireland. Yeah, I realise that's hard, but that's just me, and I'm not.
Story about your ex-girlfriend, you might have to take pictures around them football grounds.
Do you still take pictures of empty third division football stadiums, Andy? Yeah, I do actually. I love it. Look, I've just, before I did this interview, I just took my youngest daughter to play football. I find it relaxing going to a smaller game where I don't have to work. I did it on Saturday. Didn't tell anyone I was going there apart from my wife. And, you know, I spent most of the time with the family. My family are everything. Everything I do is for my family. I'm not disappearing into the pub or whatever. Yeah. And I find if you're on the ground, you just meet people. And I suppose because I watched my dad from the age of four playing semi-pro football, it was in my blood from a really, really young age. I completed the 92 in November. I didn't tell anyone. Went to Wimbledon, obviously by myself. Told my wife, she's like, what's the 92? Didn't have a clue. And, you know, the balance between work and family, it's a good question, because there's two or three times in the year where it is really full on. And that might be because of a big story, might be because I'm away at a tournament, but I make sure I put the hours in. I think people think I'm always on the road. I'm not. I've deliberately in January spent almost all the month with my family, because I am human. I'm not getting any younger. You need to just to be normal, and just going through airports all the time, it can tire you out. Yeah. But again, I'm being paid to go and interview interesting people. You know, you've been paid to go and drink beers in Belgrade with Nemanja Vidic. This is not a difficult thing to do.
Yeah, but Andy, if you didn't love it, being paid to do it would be irrelevant. The fact you have to work. So from like they want to put that time in, and that's the thing. Like me, like it's very easy as someone in your position. Okay, I'm going to do a piece. I'm not going to do research because I already know everything. But when you do research, you find out how much you don't know, and so are you forgotten about? And you know, just random details that tie together that improve, act as an adjuvant to the story, that improve what you're doing. And you know, your job is to make sure, like we said, that when someone reads something or listens to something, you say, oh, I didn't know what. And that to me is what makes something successful in journalism or media. So, you know, it just like what I was thinking about there was when you were in Brazil over Christmas and you were looking at United's Christmas results and you're on the computer and you're looking at 1931 December results and
right. I'll tell you the story, right? My wife's from Brazil. That's why I was in Brazil. I'd not been for 6 years because of COVID, because it's so expensive to go with the family. But when I go to South America, I try and interview some people while I'm there. So the only person I spoke to this time was Anderson, because he's from my wife's city and I've got a decent relationship with him. But I get there and you're thinking, right, I'm going to have a little bit of downtime now. And then news comes through that Ineos by Manchester United, and straight away I'm sat on a bed and I'm on the BBC, right, and above my head it says the word Porto Alegre, but I don't tell the in-laws that I'm on the telly. They're watching BBC World Service, what, World News, and I pop up on the telly and I'm in the next room to them, but I've not told them what I'm doing, and I can just hear them go So that's just me being pretty immature. But the fact that a major story can break on Christmas Eve shows what the job can be like. And with Manchester United, there's always stories. Mm. And even when there's not, stories are almost created out of nothing. And people come to you because they want a comment. They see you as an authority. And they might want your opinion. They might want some guidance. And that's just normal for me. And my wife accepts that. And there's times where, you know, she can come and travel with me. There's times where she'll be in the background, and it just works for us. I put the time in with the family, and I work hard, and everything I do is for them. But it can be really exciting when you break a story or you get a big interview or it all comes off. Last week, I got the number of Newport's manager.
Yeah.
And I just messaged him. Said, do you want to do an interview? And he got back 6 minutes later and said, yeah. And I'm thinking, if only every interview was this easy, because there's so many times where you've got to jump through so many hoops. Now, he was a Man United fan, and part of you is thinking he might know who you are. That's why he wants to do the interview. But I don't think he did. So I'm talking to him. I don't think he knew what United West Ham was. But by the end of the week, he's messaged me and asking if he can come on the monkey bus to an away game. But you are also the manager of Newport County. And he was a Dubliner, working class Dubliner. Really good story, really interesting lad to speak to. And you end up speaking about the human side to that person. And he actually said he regretted not seeing his kids as much as they grew up. And he said, you're changing the nappies 1 minute and the next they're driving cars. And he's playing catch up and going out with his 21-year-old daughters in Sheffield, still thinking that he's 21, but he's actually 49. And I don't want to be that person. But then Graham also knows that this is the life of a football manager. And if you want to get out of it, you can get out of it. Yeah. So a couple of lads I know who are managers, Dean Holden, he was moaning to his wife last year. She said, well, look, just get a 9-to-5 then. Don't come to me moaning because you've just lost your job, which pays you hundreds of thousands a year. Mm-hmm. And there's another lad from Manchester, Ashley Westwood.
Yeah, I'm really heard from
him. He's just taken a job as the manager of Afghanistan.
That's class.
And he's like ringing me from Kabul, telling me what's going on. And I can't write any of this.
That's class.
You know, this is all fascinating. Mm-hmm. And at some point, I will write it. So when Gary Neville was in Valencia, I was seeing him all the time in Valencia. I knew exactly what was happening, but I didn't write any of it. But when he lost his job, when he did his first interview, I was a person who was ready there to do it and to write about the disaster that was Valencia. But at times I'd be with him down there and I'm like, let's walk out the ground. Let's just walk into the main bar where all their ultras are. Mm. And Gary's like, yeah, fucking bring it on. Let's do it now. And Valencia's security are like, no, it's really dangerous for you to do that. I'm like, and me and Gary just walked out the ground, straight into a bar, had something to eat, and was fine. Most of the lads who are good at football are just working class lads who are good at football. And that's it.
It's funny because once, you know, I've gotten to know some footballers, professional athletes, and once you get past, you know, the reputation, the image that's been created in the media, and you get to know them underneath, they're just normal people. And this is part of what frustrates me whenever I see people say, this guy's making 300 grand a week. They're not sitting looking at their bank balance all day. They're dealing with the vicissitudes of life that you and I are dealing with, the same shade, same stress, same everything. Maybe they're not worried about how they're going to pay their mortgage, but believe me, they have a multitude of problems that they're dealing with. They're particularly good at one skill, but everything else, you know, is very, very difficult in their life.
It brings loads of problems. Money brings them problems. Remember the wife of a Manchester United player saying to me that she lived in a golden prison. She can buy all the handbags that she wants, but their child hated the fact that their dad played for United because they never saw him.
Yeah.
And they've got attentions of other females trying to get into their husbands all of the time.
None of us know.
Restricted. People lying about them on social media, reading untruths about themselves and their families. Now, people are not going to have much sympathy because at the end of the day, they have a lot of incredible privileges, but it is not a bed of roses. It really isn't. I do not cover a lot of what they go through at all.
I have spoken to family members of high-profile football players. Remember, family members, they're reading stuff about, it's not a footballer, that's their husband, that's their dad. And it's, you can mean Harry Maguire is a perfect example of this. Imagine how it must have felt for Maguire to read, you know, getting bomb threats, to read the most disgraceful abuse that went way beyond criticizing a footballer, where you're like, you know, there's an old saying, fame is the excrement of success. People think they want it, but your anonymity, your privacy, your ability to switch off is so valuable. Social media has completely changed everything. On that, as a journalist, because one of the banes of journalists is aggregator accounts and how they will take quotes, take them out of context, they build these massive followings, and oftentimes deliberately misrepresent your work. There's a lot of contempt for high football that's covered these days, aggregator accounts. And of course, there's fan comms. I'm not here to criticize anyone in particular. I'm no better than anyone else. But what's your particular view of both those outlets?
Aggregator accounts, I think they're parasites. I think they feed off the hard work that people like I do. and pump it out there. And I don't like them, and I've taken several of them to task. Like one of them last week. Okay, give you an example. So there was a meeting at Old Trafford with all the Ineos people. And through my contacts that have taken 20 years to build up, I spoke to six different people who were in those four different meetings. Why did they speak to me? Because they trust me. Why do I write the article? Because I think Manchester United fans should know what's going on. Article goes out. I get paid for it. I need to get paid because I need to earn money, because I can't go to my bank manager and say, I can't pay the mortgage this month, but I'm really popular because I've got loads of likes. I need a thing called money. And so many aggregator accounts ripped it off. I don't mind them taking two tweets and saying Andy Mitten says this or The Athletic says this. Now with the longer tweets, one of them took seven tweets. Massive long tweets. Just they take your copy. They also twist out of context what you've said.
I know.
And suddenly, like, I didn't write that. He didn't say that.
I see it all the time.
And some of the mainstream outlets, it's not just aggregator accounts, can be really bad for it as well. And this idea that they're giving me exposure is bollocks.
Yeah.
You don't need exposure. Nobody clicks through who goes on the account.
Probably great. Neither does it know who you are or anyway, Andy. I mean, so it's not like some, oh, Andy Midden, who's that? Oh, so it's not, yeah, so I know what you mean. Sorry, carry on.
It's so it is frustrating, and I think the social media companies are allowing false news and untruths to get out there. You're starting to see that a lot more in football now. Been investigating some of them, so that'll be coming out as an article pretty soon. And, you know, when I speak to these people, I'll be like, because they'll say in their bios that they're in Manchester, and they're not. And the pictures will be like of a footballer or some generic account. I just think it's so disingenuous, because when I do my job, I've got to look people in the eye who I've written about, be it footballers. I've got to stand on the street outside Old Trafford, and I've got a there are responsibilities which comes with what I write, and I have to back that up. People can agree or disagree with me. People can think I'm a good or bad writer. That's absolutely fine. But I'm seeing good journalists losing their jobs. And I spoke to one of these aggregator accounts, and they said, we're doing what we do responsibly. I said, you're stealing every single picture you put out there. And I know a photographer who's lost his job last week.
Yeah, it's not right.
People like you thieving his work. So I'm sorry, I'm not a big fan. I get that there's a huge demand for free content, but the way that they often portray my words and words of other people is totally disingenuous.
And
there's a lot of journalists work really hard, but they need to be paid.
100%. And I have no problems paying subscription fees for journalism, because I understand that. I mean, anything that's worth, you know, I have no making sure a journalist makes money. I understand there's an uptake for free content, but if you want well-researched journalism that takes resources, it takes time, it takes you, I mean, an inordinate amount of your time to do that and to do it right, I pay subscription fees for lots of different things. I have no problems paying for good journalism. So plagiarizing that and putting it back out there on a free account, you know, is to me totally unacceptable. And look, social media has changed everything. It's changed everything with footballers. It's changed everything, even with myself. And I've had to learn a lot about myself with social media, because sometimes I'll cringe at some of the stuff I put on social media an hour later, where I feel my emotions have calmed down. I feel completely different about something. And you can't delete it, because that looks disingenuous. Where I'm looking at this going, you know, maybe I need to learn about being more measured, about waiting for, and always the take an hour later is better than the one that you immediately put out, because it's a lot more, you know, it takes a lot more information and the consideration. And then I have to accept, you know, some of my takes can be abrasive, and that has, you know, an impact on someone on the other end. The other thing is, you know, you can get dragged into arguments, because inevitably, you know, people will say things to you to provoke you. How do you manage that, said Andy? Because you have to be very disciplined in your communication on social media to not get dragged into that stuff. So do you have a burner account, or do you have something that you do where you can be able to have normal conversations without having to get dragged into that?
I don't have a burner account. I'm pretty sensible. You're right in what you're saying. Often on social media, there's this demand for immediacy. What yes. are you saying now? So yes. this season, I'm in Old Trafford. I can see that there's Galatasaray fans all over the stadium. This shouldn't be happening. What are you saying, Mitten? What's going on? We're doing this. The club are doing that. Club. Wait a minute.
Well, you said about this. You didn't say about that.
Mm. Let us find out properly what's going on, which we did do. We spoke to everybody. We spoke to the club. We spoke to fans. We said, how have you got your ticket in this section? We spoke to UEFA. And then we published a piece 3 weeks later full of accurate details. By that time, your instant reaction brigade have moved on to something else. Tell me, what do you think now? I just don't serve those people. I think you listen to yourself. Sometimes you're in the mood. Sometimes you're not in the mood. You see people trying to hook you all the time. Just fucking ignore them.
Yeah.
Or if they're abusive, if they threaten you, just block them. Or just twice a year, I'll say to someone, look, if you've got a problem, meet me. Never. They never, ever, ever meet you.
But outside of football, Andy, social issues, you know, political issues. I mean, this is something I wish I was more disciplined in. I mean, you must be on social media, you must see something, someone says something that just offends your sensibilities, where you want to jump in, you want to say, how do you have the discipline? Like, you know what? Put the phone down, go do something else.
And sometimes you just go for someone, especially if you're big. And as long as you're factually correct, I mean, that's an important thing. I mean, been a couple of cases in the last year where people have had a dig at me, and I've just been like, okay, you want to be like that, do you? This is the last thing you sent to me, and this, and then they go, oh, and they back down straight away. And I think you can be good at social media, you can be bad at it, but what do you want from it? I could easily put out knee-jerk reactions and get loads of tweets and likes or whatever, but I don't do that. It's just not me. I think you've got to be true to your own personality as well, and sometimes you should pause, get a fuller picture of what you're actually going to go about. But at other times you just see something in front of you and think, whoa, this is brilliant. I remember being at Ibrox for a feature about Rangers, and they were playing Legia Warsaw, and the Legia Warsaw fans unfurled this massive banner of Pope John Paul, and I'm like, is that who I think it is? And I asked the journalist next to me, because Ibrox isn't my patch. Mm-hmm. And he goes, aye. And I thought, I need one more source than this. Excuse me, who is that flag of? Yeah, it's the Pope. And I'm thinking, well, the Pope was a footballer. So Legia Warsaw, their fans have just got a massive flag of a former goalkeeper who just happened to be the Pope. That is brilliant. I did a third and final check. Excuse me, mate. Yeah, you're a journalist. You're from Glasgow. Could you just tell me who that banner is over there? Yeah, it's the Pope. And you tweet it out, and it goes totally viral. Totally viral. And even Rangers fans are going, fair play. That is brilliant that they've carried that off inside Ibrox. Mm-hmm. And other times, remember being in the Bernabeu, Ajax fans were singing Always Look on the Bright Side of Life. They'd just seen the team managed by Erik ten Hag beat Real Madrid. And I'm there. And I put it out there, and Eric Idle, who wrote the song, retweets it. And it's a buzz when that happens.
Of course.
Sometimes, you can't spill your story. I remember once a magazine sent me to interview a player, and I put a picture out of him, and they're like, no, we've paid for you to go there. Let us publish it, not you. And I learned that. This was in the infancy of social media. And I get that. And sometimes you get it wrong. I think a couple of things have changed with Twitter. People can now buy the blue ticks, which it muddies the waters a little bit because people don't know who to trust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think exaggerated opinions are amplified. And that's,
of course,
I try and write with balance, with context. My loyalty is to telling my readers the truth.
Yes.
But if I went out there now and said, X player is absolutely disgraceful, I know it would go viral, But that's just not me. It's not fair either, because I might have to face that player.
Yeah. And that's always what makes it more complicated, is when you know the person rather than the avatar. You know, and you know the human being, and you know that it's a lot more nuanced than just a black and white story of it's an absolute disgrace and you don't want to go in two-footed. Look, I've been guilty of some of this in the past myself, but as you age, you realize, and as you get to know people, you realize it's not as black and white as that. And I completely understand, you know, I'll ask you about this. I ask people about this, for example, with Ferguson. A lot of United fans have complicated views on Sir Alex. You were, you know, to address something that gets leveled at you from time to time about not being anti-Glazer. I mean, you need to look at the history of what happened when, you know, you went to the government to ask for intervention. You know, you were obviously front and center with Andy Walsh, and, you know, John Bones, you know, JP, all in the beginning to oppose the Glazer takeover. A lot has happened since then. Ferguson has taken some culpability in them being there. How do you feel about Ferguson's role in the Glazers being at United?
Well, it was integral to it, because of the Rock of Gibraltar, and they are the facts. It's indisputable. Mm-hmm. And you can feel conflicted. You can hold different opinions on the same person. That man is probably Manchester United's greatest ever manager.
Yes.
And has enriched all of our lives greatly. I've traveled the world because of that man. Yeah. When I started going to games, European football was a dream, partly because English teams were banned.
Yeah.
On a human side, I have part of my family who knew him very, very well. And I never really made that public. So I'd have times where he'd like go around to my dad's house. And hear incredibly good things about not just him, but his wife, Kathy, very loyal lady.
Of course.
Remember sitting next to Kathy at a 70th for Norman Davis, the former kit man. And we just spoke about the River Clyde and the docks and the ship workers. It's wonderful. We didn't even talk about football.
Yeah.
And then I've had him shouting at me, where you're thinking, you absolute prick, you're wrong. And I'm allowed to think that as well.
Yes,
and
of course.
Other times where he's going at you, he didn't get it right all the time. At times when he could be horrendous bully with the media.
Yeah.
And get things totally wrong. And this was his whole shtick, and it worked for him. And the way that he continues to be a successful manager is incredible. But he was complicit with the Glazers coming in. And he used to say,
it wouldn't have happened.
It's what?
You think if he'd opposed him, it wouldn't have happened?
Yeah. I think it would have been very difficult, because he was such an important man. I've tried to look at it from his perspective when he was saying things like the great owners. Well, from his perspective, they probably were, because they didn't interfere. And there's a lot of interfering owners in football.
Sure.
They backed him financially. So for him, someone who's been sacked as a manager in Scotland and worked under some absolute bastards, the Glazers probably felt like decent owners to him.
He was also dealing with that Cubic Expression, 99 questions, you know, where they were investigating,
He got well out of his depth there. So when them 99 questions landed, it's like, okay, you want to be a smart ass, do you?
Mm-hmm.
Answer these. And I think suddenly he's thought, whoa, whoa, whoa. Because football's full of bullshitters. It's an industry where there's so many versions of the truth. And
you see on that, Andy? Just a quick... I spoke to Mark Bosnich. And Mark Bosnich told me the reason why United missed out on Alan Shearer was because Ferguson was pressuring David Beckham to leave. I think it was Tony Stevens was his agent, into saying with his son, but understand that he represented Alan Shearer at the time, and he was threatening to sue Ferguson. And he was telling me that was the reason why Stevens pushed Shearer to Newcastle.
I'd not heard that one. It might be true. It might not be true. I don't know. I was gutted. I was gutted when he didn't come, partly because I spent most of the summer of 96 really looking forward to Alan Shearer joining Manchester United. Traveled across America with me mates.
Yeah.
going in clubs in Chicago, having a great time, getting the cheapest hotels we could find, and just checking for information as to whether Alan Shearer had signed or not.
Yeah.
And he never did. I think in football, you seem to be weak if you don't have a strong opinion. And yeah. Even now, and it's an important part of my job, this, I'm getting people to this day, today, giving me polar opposite opinions on the same subject. One of them saying this guy is a bluffer, he's a blagger, and the other person saying he's really smart, he's really good. So where does the truth lie?
Mm-hmm.
And it's my job to decipher that, but I'm not judge and jury here.
Sure.
And moods change so quickly in football as well. I think the way that the Glazers came in, I remember interviewing David Gill on the preseason tour, and he spoke well of Malcolm. But then again, Sir Jim Ratcliffe speaks well of the Glazers now. And as you said earlier, it's not black and white. There's so many shades of grey here. And at the moment, I think there's a groundswell for Jim Ratcliffe is good, Ineos is good, and it may turn out to be good. And that's great. I certainly don't feel about them as I felt about the Glazers, going back to the time that you talked about when the protests were going on, when FC United were formed.
Mm-hmm.
My brother was one of the first players to play for FC, caused a huge division in the fan base. And
yes,
some of that still persists to this day. And
of course.
United fans are not united a lot of the time. A lot of United fans don't like each other. And they're a collective of mates where they all think that what them and their small group of mates think is what everyone should think. What they don't realise is there's thousands of these little groups. And I see these character traits from within United's fan base that gone on for years. Well, I don't like him. Why do you not like him? Well, because didn't see him at that game over there.
Mm-hmm.
What? It's just mental sometimes, fandom, and how people change the tunes in fandom as well. I think history will remember Ferguson very well as an incredible football manager. But you're allowed to say that he made mistakes. And when Sir Bobby Charlton passed away, we put him on the front cover of United We Stand. Great, great, great footballer. Often a great person, but not always a great person because he's human. And I think most of the people listening to this have got their foibles themselves. So, you know, Sir Matt Busby. If you spoke to my Uncle Charlie about Sir Matt Busby, he would have a very different view.
Great for United.
Wouldn't let him come back and play for them. But then Charlie shouldn't have broken his contract. But then players shouldn't have been slaves at the times. So was Charlie a trailblazer, or was he greedy for going off to Colombia and breaking his contract?
Well, I think
football throws up these questions all the time.
Anyone that holds scrutiny to any human being's life is going to find yin and yang. Right? That's just how we're programmed. Right? There's that element of irreducible rascality in all of us. You know, we're not always, you know, I've got my prejudices. I'm not above being a dickhead many, many times. And I think it's important that sometimes you own your shit and say, look, I'm wrong. I shouldn't have done that. You know, yeah, benefit of hindsight, I reacted totally wrong and, you know, or done something that was unethical. You know, I've been battled, you know, addiction, depression, and all that. And during those times, I've done some horribly selfish, stupid things that I deeply regret. So I think, you know, there's, you know, unless something is really character defining, it's super evil. You know, I mean, a lot of it you just have to dismiss. But let me ask you about Edward Bird. I don't want to keep you too long. A few other questions I want to get through. But Edward Bird, vilified figure. And to get back to what we're saying, I met Ed a couple of times. And I have to say, as a human being to be in this company, I was quite a decent guy, right? And I know a lot of United fans will be livid over something like that, but I can only tell you the truth. And I met him in 2014, and he obviously at that time had big ideas about what he wanted to do with United. And I know that he was trying to change David Gill. David Gill didn't like Ed, and you know, but he had big ideas. Didn't work out that way. What's your opinion on Edward Bird and his contribution that where United are at right now?
I don't think history will remember Edward Wood's contribution well. You're quite right when you say if you're in his company, is personable. You wouldn't get to his level if you didn't have good social skills. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the reasons he got the job. But he was a banker. Mm-hmm. He was in the wrong job. He shouldn't have been in charge of Manchester United. I think he tried his best. I think he wanted United to be successful. Of course he did. He was paid a lot of money to try and make Manchester United successful. But I travel around Europe seeing top sports directors, and they're on a different level in terms of their football acumen than Ed Woodward would have been. And I think he got dealt an unlucky card in as soon as he got the job. Ferguson went and Gil went. I think he tried to be his own man, but those two pillars of Manchester United's success had both gone. What did Ed Woodward do right? I think the fan communication really improved. Him and Richard Arnold deserve some credit for that. Fans will always say that they're people who loved football more, loved rugby more. They were bankers. They were handpicked by the Glazers. None of those things resonate in a positive way. And I totally understand why. But if Ed Woodward would have been at the helm as Manchester United won two or three league titles, my tone would be different. I remember seeing him in his office 2019 for a United We Stand interview, which I got a lot of stick for. So I'm like, what do you want me to do? Just interview popular people? Because that's really, really dangerous for journalism.
Who wouldn't take that interview, Andy?
Who what?
Who wouldn't take that interview? Everyone would have taken
it all day long. I'd ask the same questions. And as a journalist, you know, you interview Nemanja Vidic and everyone goes, this is great because he's great. You're a wonderful writer, Andy. I'm sorry. Some people don't see beyond the name. Mm-hmm. I should still be allowed to scrutinize Ed Woodward or Richard Arnold or whoever and say, why is this happening? What's going wrong there? What are you doing about it? And as a journalist, you should do that. Mm-hmm. And because he's an unpopular person, that might be quite uncomfortable reading. But we've always done that. We did it with Martin Edwards. We did it with Peter Kenyon. We did it with David Gill. I think it's an important part of a fanzine to do that. It wasn't easy to sit down and interview Erik ten Hag before Christmas, but he gave us an hour of his time. And I think he knew who our readers were. And I think he wanted him on side and let him have his say, push back on other stuff. And Woodward now, he's out of the football area. If I bumped into him in the street, I'd say hello to him. He was always that personable with me on a human level. Part of me is frustrated. These people were incredibly well paid and presided over a football club, which was failing. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of blaggers who've worked at Manchester United over the years. And if there's anything consistent in what I've done, and I've done it for 35 years now, Phil, it's people are always saying big change is coming, mm-hmm. big change is happening, lots of people going, lots of people coming in. Well, it's always been like that. It's always been like that. And if you're not achieving, you're going to lose your job. And he lost his job ultimately because of the European Super League. He told me his version of the
probably told you the same thing, but he said it nonetheless.
Remember, he used the word serendipity. So maybe he told you the same thing. And I've no doubt that he believes his version of the truth. Mm. I think if you're going to work for the Glazers like that and you're going to take their money, then you're going to be beholden to them because you've got to deliver to them. I think he delivered,
and that's a thing
for them. But you know, under him, United's recruitment left a lot to be desired. So you can't
say it was derivative of the Glazers' priorities. So if it wasn't there, it'd be someone else. Let me ask you quickly about that. Solskjaer, obviously, some of the big signings, was Ronaldo, Van de Beek, and Ed signing, or were those all his signings?
I think that Donny van de Beek is one of the great mysteries because when he signed, I spoke to a member of the coaching staff and I said, okay, Donny van de Beek just signed. Where is he going to play? And the answer was, I don't know. Like, why has he been signed? I suspect, though I cannot prove, that he was signed because at the time, United fans were up in arms that no one had been signed. He was available. Young Ajax midfielder who's been doing really well, is very sellable to the fan base. But he was a flop. And I don't celebrate the fact that he was a flop. I remember watching him very closely during COVID inside Old Trafford with her coach against Watford in the FA Cup. And Watford were a championship team. Donny van der Beek should have been standing out a mile. He was one of the worst players on the pitch. I don't even like saying this, but it's the truth. And you've got to tell the truth. So he was one of many signings that United got wrong. Why didn't it work out? With some players, they can handle the pressure. They can't handle the pressure. With Ronaldo, I asked Ollie directly about it. I think that it was put to him, would you like Ronaldo? And I think he said yes. I think in hindsight, cost him his job. I really do. Yeah, I think it cost him his job. Because even though he was successful in the first season, he had such an unsettling effect on that dressing room. Now you can see that two ways. His version is, I demanded excellence. Mm-hmm. Other people might say, no, you're a prick. Because the manager should be the most important thing at a football club. And Ole Gunnar Solskjaer was being undermined by Cristiano Ronaldo. And he'd never say that publicly.
Well, Perez called him a weirdo or something, didn't he?
Perez called who a weirdo?
Ronaldo.
Did he?
Yes, he's a really weird... That was a famous clip of...
look at him. He's become one of the best two players in the world, maybe the best, depending on your opinion, by being who he is. It's all about him. And he's so driven, and you've got to say his life's been a massive success. He, too, has enriched my life greatly. I remember being in Olympico in Rome when he scored a header, thinking, oh, my God, am I really watching Manchester United going to Roma away and battering them?
He was sensational.
Absolutely sensational.
He really was.
I got swept along by it when he came back, Phil. I loved it. I think brilliant. He's still got it. You know, you can Google what I wrote about him at the time. I was convinced by it. But by the end, I think Erik ten Hag got it right. I think he handled it quite well in the end. But Ed Woodward did the numbers on that. I remember the day he signed. So leads back into some of the things you said. I'm on the first day of a family holiday in Croatia and Ronaldo signs. So my phone lights up and I've got to do 11 interviews.
Yeah.
And I just have to say to my wife, it's going to be one of them days. And there'll be like 3 days a year when it just goes mad. Mm. But then I'm paid to do those interviews and that money goes back into the family. And someone very senior at Manchester United saw me doing one of those interviews on Sky and said, Ed deserves the credit for this. Ed's done the numbers for this. Ed's pulled off a miracle here. Mm. And you know what? When you're getting that, you're thinking, fair play, Ed.
Yeah.
But now you're thinking, no, you got it wrong.
Yeah.
In hindsight,
but to be fair, there wasn't too many United fans were disappointed at the time when he signed. It was that first game against Newcastle was, truthfully, it was amazing just to see him back in United shirt. He'd score for the football club. But I want to ask you a couple of little dopey questions before you leave. But before I do that, I want to ask you: you do a lot of work. You run a marathon this weekend. You did amazing. With the United Foundation, you've done a bike ride to John O'Groats. You do a lot for charity, which is something that you should be commended for. On your own personal life, Andy, have you ever had to deal with depression or anything? Have you been able to keep that away? How do you manage your own mental health?
I try and eat well, I try and sleep well. I still play football. I exercise a lot. There's times where, it can get a bit full on. So I just, as you get older, you get wiser. You listen to your body. You know when you're tired. Your wife knows when you're tired. You surround yourself with good people, with people who will impact on your life positively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I realize that I can't go into every battle that I want to go into.
Yes.
I pick my fights carefully. I've got to correct you. I didn't run a marathon this weekend. I wish I had done. I ran 10K.
That's a marathon to me.
I was delighted with it, but I'm training to do a first ever marathon in April, and I'm a long way off that at the moment. I'm going to run it in Manchester. We did that Barcelona to Manchester bike ride. Me, my brothers, JP O'Neill. We bought two ambulances with that. I didn't train for that, Phil, and I'm with them idiots. And I'd say on the record, all of them are absolute idiots. They're going out drinking every night and they were fitter than me. I was the weakest cyclist of them all. They're having like 8 pints a night. So I made sure that when I did Land's End John O'Groats, I properly trained for that. I really did. And it was one of the greatest experiences of my life. I did it for Man United's Foundation. Foundation's fantastic. Stuff that they do in the communities, especially around Manchester, is a good thing. I lost my dad at 69, Phil. My dad was a footballer. He was a fit fella. I turned 50 just before Christmas, and I thought, have I only got 19 years left?
Yeah.
And the probability is that I won't have. But, you know, I just saw my dad get cancer at 56, and he had it for 13 years. And you think, we're not here for that long. I mean, so that's one of our writers, Mike Duff, he wrote a poem years ago, Use Every Minute to Live. And it was read out at my wedding. And that's why I try and pack so much into life. I think life's a beautiful thing. And it should be enjoyed. And, you know, everyone has good and bad days. But on balance, it's a beautiful thing. And I think people should try and make the most of it if they can.
Yeah, and it's about being influenced by the right people, like you say, and eliminating that toxicity out of your life. All right, a couple of quick fire questions. What signing that United didn't make during your time at United did you wish they had? Ronaldinho, is that the one that you feel wish we had got that one done?
Yeah, because I mean, he ended up going to Barcelona. I ended up interviewing him a lot. Ended up marrying a girl from his city. When I told him that, he looked at me. He said, "What? Just repeat this again. You're going to marry a girl from my city. Why is she with you, looking like you?" Thinking, I'm not getting shit here off Ronaldinho, because you ain't no David Beckham, by the way, Ronaldinho. He was a magician. He was a wonderful footballer. So, yeah, him. But then I loved it when Juan Verón signed and it didn't quite work out. Shearer was a fantastic number nine. Fergie got it right most times. And even with some of the post-Fergie signings, I was so excited when Falcao signed. I met him a few months ago. Lovely fella. Lovely man.
Yes, I heard about him.
Alexis Sanchez, met him, didn't think much of him. I was buzzing when he signed. At some point, our luck's got to turn, hasn't it? It just has to. So Jude Bellingham would have been great.
By the way,
Haaland, these two were gettable.
On that, your Neil Wood interview, what you did, where you said Jude Bellingham's chipping the keeper at 13 years of age from halfway in. If you haven't listened to that, go listen to that interview on the Air That We Stand podcast. Absolutely brilliant. So, I would have loved. It's funny because I interviewed Harry Redknapp when he was at Birmingham, and he said to me, best young midfielder he'd ever had. Okay, your favourite movie of all time?
Movie? What was the one? Dead Man's Shoes.
Dead Man's Shoes? I haven't seen it. What's that about?
Oh, it's a fantastic one. I filmed in a Nottinghamshire pit village. And it's about life and...
Me and Debbie Does Dallas, but before we started recording on it. So Dead Man's Shoes. Okay, I got it.
British actor called Paddy Considine. It's a Shane Meadows film. And it's a very, very gritty English film, which I love. I love military history. I love history. So when I'm watching films about the Second World War, I'm fascinated by that. I've watched some incredible documentaries about Northern Ireland in the last couple of years. Incredible television. One by the BBC last year. So I've got a thirst for knowledge. I read a lot. I want to learn all the time. When I go somewhere new, I get my phone out, and I can't just pass a village and not know about that village. I need to know what it's about and culture. There's a lot of people, but that's just how I'm built.
I'd say the football, your history buff, you're someone like, what are you listening to? Reading?
Love music, love books. Wish I had more time to read books. My best books, Catcher in the Rye when I was a kid, I love that. A book called Powder by Kevin Sampson, who was a Liverpoolian, big Liverpool fan, about the music industry. Mm-hmm. I mean, look behind me, all these books I bought, 95% of them, all that music. I just consume as much as I can. I've got a voracious appetite for learning. I feel like I don't know enough about the American Civil War, and that annoys me, and it shouldn't annoy me. But I feel like if I was sent to jail, I'd just read nonstop, just learn, fill in the blanks in my area, in my brain. If there's something that, if I meet someone where I don't know a lot about the subject, I'm keen to absorb new information all the time. So Anthony Beauvoir's books about history, I really like them. Yes, I love it. I
spend a lot of time reading books on science and philosophy because I just am really interested in that type of stuff. And I stopped becoming religious. I suppose I was never really that religious, but after my wife-to-be died and I just really started examining stuff, and you know, I became really interested in philosophy and science. So your top five songs on your iPod?
Off the top of my head, my favorite song ever. Wow. Massive Attack Unfinished Sympathy is one of my favorite ever songs, filmed in Los Angeles. When United were in LA, I tried to trace the route where the video was filmed. Didn't realize those big avenues in LA go on for like 30 kilometers. Got the wrong end of the avenue. Made the right knob out myself. Love the Smiths. Radiohead, I like a lot. Not very cool to say this, but I saw Coldplay in concert last year and was completely blown away. Realize that's a very mainstream option. Love house music, a lot of that music that came out of Chicago and Detroit,
yeah,
and became really popular in Northern England in the same way that the Northern Soul came out of North America.
Yeah,
I love that. Buy a lot of music. So I've mentioned a few songs there.
Okay, best advice you've ever had. Almost done. Two questions, we're done.
Say that again.
Best advice you've ever had.
I just sort of found my own way, you know. Parents split when I was 13. I don't know. I just listened to, just listened to people and then formed my own opinion.
I mean, I would assume it's advice you give your kids about, you know, what to prioritize in life.
If you're not particularly religious, but if you're following the Ten Commandments, you can't go far wrong in life. Just about being a good person. I think because a lot of young journalists come to me. And I just say, in terms of writing, be bright, be right, be accurate. Don't be an arsehole. Be reliable. Be someone who can be trusted, and just be straight with people. Sometimes you have to have difficult conversations, and if I have to have them, I get them out of the way as early as I can. In the day, face them head on. Don't hide. But I don't know. I keep saying it. Life's a beautiful thing. It can be relished, but. You know, everyone has difficult moments as well.
I think the best advice I was given is money buys pleasure, doesn't buy happiness. And you need to understand the difference. Pleasure are completely different things. And when I was a drug addict, I understood the difference. You know, that drug made me feel pleasure for a minute, but it had nothing to do with happiness. All right, last one. Tell me a joke. Here we go.
I can't do it. You can't just catch me out like this. I know...
You have to have a dad joke somewhere.
I've not even got a dad joke.
I've
actually been stumped in an interview for the first time. I can't even give you a decent dad joke.
No, I have to learn.
And I know that this is going to end, and I'm going to be thinking, oh shit, why didn't I say that? I tell you what's a joke. Manchester United under the Glazers, bang.
I'll give you one. Knock knock.
Who's there?
Interrupting Kai. Go.
That's gone right over my head. Look at you laughing. You can't laugh at your own jokes.
I was going to tell you a joke about paper, but it's terrible.
Right. So I've got to finish the fanzine. There's my planner sheet. And I'm going to.
What are we saying?
Outside your wind at Wolves. To it, Andy. On the 1st of February and sell the current issue. There's
where
the glamour in my
it?
Life.
And where people can find it. So I'll put a link in, but find at UWS Mag.
UWSonline.com. Yeah, if you subscribe. I suppose if you're in the States, The digital version is the one that downloads onto your tablet, but right, we do have a lot of people who get the printed version. The only problem is the postal costs keep going up, and it takes a couple of weeks to get there. But in the same way that people love vinyl records, some people love printed mags. I get that. I'm just looking through the latest issues. So much good stuff in there, and stuff you wouldn't find. There's a big feature on one of the big United pubs in Manchester, where one of our young writers has gone in there, spoke to the landlord, got some pictures. Where else are you going to find that? But there's a place for it in the fanzine.
They're absolutely brilliant. Andy, I know you're a busy man, and I didn't plan on taking this much of your time, but thank you so much for taking the time to do this. You're someone that I have tremendous respect for as a human being and for your work. I appreciate all the work that you do, certainly for me as a United fan. I have to choose carefully the people that I listen to, and yourself, Laurie, Carl, Ian, and everyone else who contributes to UWS are fantastic. So thank you so much, mate. I wish you all the best, and thanks for taking the time to do this.
Thanks a lot, Phil. Take care, and hopefully it's not gone on for too long for people.
Thanks, mate. Take it easy. Bye.